Now, detonate the reality bomb!
As we get caught up in the affairs of the day, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that all around us, an invisible war is taking place. A battle that has raged since the beginning of time and will continue until the Lord declares that time is at an end. Our guest tonight, here to talk about that, is a prolific author and speaker. He's the author of books, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, the Nephilim Trilogy, Cosmic Chess Match, most recently, On the Trail of the Nephilim. He blogs regularly at lamarzulli.wordpress.com, and he's the host of Acceleration Radio, Thursday evenings at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, and now doing video as well as he continues his assault on all forms of media. The Watcher series of DVD, yes, Howard Stern, watch out. Most recently, Watchers 6, The Secret Cosmic War. It is our honor and pleasure to welcome back to the bunker L.A. Marzulli. L.A., good to talk with you again.
Great to be here, and the pleasure is all mine, Derek. Thanks so much for having me back on. Appreciate it.
You know, as I've said before, and I'm not ashamed to admit, it was your novel, Nephilim, that was my real sort of introduction into the topic. I had heard about it somewhere, went looking at our local library in St. Louis County, found a copy, read it, was like, wow, well, why aren't we hearing about this at church? And went to the church library, found Chuck Missler's book, of course, the name of which is going to escape me now, the one he wrote with Mark Eastman.
Alien Encounters.
Alien Encounters, right, which offered a biblical perspective on the UFO phenomenon. And that led my naturally curious and science fiction-oriented mind into looking for biblical explanations for the things that we aren't supposed to be able to answer. You've done a lot of this and been out on point on a lot of these issues. And as such, you know, as in a military confrontation, the guy who walks point usually is the one who gets shot at first. And you caught your share of flak, friendly fire, I might add.
Yes.
The work that you've been doing, let's just step back and take an overview, because, you know, a lot of folks who are saying, you know, we really ought to focus on the gospel and point people to the cross. What does the UFO phenomenon, what do the Nephilim, these sort of unexplained paranormal, you know, the cryptic sorts of things have to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ?
Well, it really has everything to do with it. You know, we're told to watch for the signs in the heavens. And all this, in my opinion, is completely dovetailed together. In other words, when we talk about the gospel, a lot of people, specifically in the New Age circles, the people that come across my desk and send me emails that are really curious, the ancient alien crowd, the UFO guys, the UFO seekers, the people that, let's say, follow Rael, who believes in extraterrestrials that seated us here, the channelers, all these people are looking for answers, and we have the answers. But it's been dressed up so long in like the trappings of the church that many of these people just run to the nearest exit. They don't want anything to do with it. And what we do, or let me put it this way, what I try to do with all my work, with all my books, is to take sort of the religion out of Christianity and just tell people the good news. And oftentimes with the work that I do, specifically not only with my partner Richard Shaw in Watchers, we'll take these very hard to deal with subjects and just throw the information out. And then at the very end, we'll kind of tie it in to a biblical worldview, but we're not like preaching to people. And we get over and over again, people are buying Watchers and holding Watchers parties and inviting their unsaved friends over because they're not embarrassed to show it. And it's not pounding people over the head with Bible verses, which comes later. I mean, look, you just tell people the good news in a language that people can understand without all the religious trappings. And people go, wow, that sounds really good. You know what? Yeah, how do I sign up for this? Or, you know, who is this Jesus guy anyway? It's not the Jesus you're telling me about seems totally different than the Jesus I see on most Christian TV programs. And that's, to me, that's like a badge of honor. And frankly, we're told to watch for the signs of his return. And in my opinion, specifically, these signs, wars and rumors of wars, famines, earthquakes, pestilence, all this stuff is happening in real time. And then we jump to 2 Thessalonians. It says Satan comes with all signs and lying wonders. And we ignore that at our own peril. And the idea behind that is this fallen cherub, as Russ Dizzer likes to call him, has been working on this coming great deception literally for thousands of years. And so when it hits, and I believe it's sort of hitting already, especially with the videos that we look at and the people that we talk to, the UFO phenomena is increasing, is burgeoning, it's real, it's not going away. And we do ourselves a disservice by not understanding the times that we live in and the supernatural events that are manifesting in real time all around us.
There are skeptics out there who will take a critical look at the work that you're doing and that others in the field are doing and dismiss it as adding science fiction to the Bible. How does their interpretation, say, of Genesis chapter 6 affect their analysis of what's going on? In other words, looking at the UFO phenomenon, acknowledging that it's real, and then trying to fit it into a biblical framework. How does one's interpretation of Genesis chapter 6, angels who came down from heaven and took wives, versus the Sethite view, in other words, producing giants versus the Sethite view, the line of Seth, the godly line of Seth versus the evil line of Cain. How does that influence one's look at the UFO phenomenon from a biblical perspective?
Well, it influences it in in a profound way. Basically, if a person holds on to the Sethite view, which we all know, when I say we, my colleagues and I have nailed this down, specifically a lot of the work of Doug Hamp, but also Mike Heiser has talked about this, certainly Judd Burton, a whole host of us, Gary Stearman, Prophecy of the News, Tom Horn, Chris Putman, we're all very much aware of the Sethite theory being sort of thrown onto the church in the fourth century and what had been the rabbinical tradition of the idea of the fallen angelic host came down in the days of Jared, 200 of them, and had sex with the women, was just completely taken out. And this Sethite view, which was shoehorned in, which in my opinion is really torturing the text, was created by Augustine and others around the 4th century. And here we are in modernity, and this is the view that's promulgated at Dallas Seminary and in other seminaries. Look, I've had people, I spoke up at Sparks, Nevada about 2 weeks ago at a small church, but it was amazing because there were eight pastors from other churches who attended on Friday night. It was a two-hour lecture on UFOs and then all day Saturday, and many of them returned on Saturday. Eight pastors from different denominations, different churches, and 10 assistant pastors attended on Friday night. And then many of them came back on Saturday, and I was just blown away by that. And we had lots of questions, a lot of curious people who were curious about what was this all about. Several pastors were taking notes furiously, sat up in the front, taking notes furiously. And two of them came up to me and thanked me profusely for coming there and shedding light on what, for them, had always been a mystery. And the presentations that I do, Derek, you know, we actually show real footage of stuff. It's just not me up there blabbing and, well, I think this is happening. We've got hardcore physical scientific evidence, which I show in these presentations. And so the bottom line is anyone who holds to the Sethite view, when they get to Jesus's proclamation that says, it'll be like the days of Noah when I return, well, what does that have to do with anything? It has everything to do with everything. Jesus is warning us that it'll be like the days of Noah, which begs the question, what differentiates those days? And if one holds on to the Sethite view, well, how are we going to get that today? Where are the ungodly line of Cain? And where is the goodly line of Seth, the godly line of Seth? You can't find it. I mean, it's an absurd position. But the moment we plug in the fallen angelic host, wait a minute. And then we say, what's manifesting now? Oh, my gosh, look, UFOs, 1,000 of them sighted in the month of April. Unprecedented numbers of UFOs being sighted all over the globe. It's time that the church wake up and understand that we're the people that believe in the virgin birth, floating access, talking donkeys, two gold coins which appear in a fish's mouth, staves which turn into serpents, guys that walk on water, men that are swallowed by giant fish, regurgitated 3 days later, staves that hit rocks that flow out enough water to quench the thirst of a million people, and on it goes. And that's crazy stuff. You want to talk about science fiction, you know, talking donkeys? Come on. This isn't the Disney Channel, is it? And yet we believe this stuff in the Bible, and I believe it's literal. There was a talking donkey. Absolutely. It was there. Jonah was swallowed by a great fish. It happened. Moses' snake, his staff did, you know, turn into a snake and eat the other snakes that the magicians had thrown down, their staffs as well. I mean, all that's, we travel on this stuff, we read it, and yet for some reason, when we walk outside, we go click, we flick the switch, and it's like cognitive dissonance. Well, these things can't be really happening now, can they? Oh my gosh, we're told Satan comes of all signs and lying wonders. It's here, folks. It's manifesting. A modicum of research will show us that the phenomenon is real, burgeoning, not going away. These things are being photographed everywhere globally. Thousands of people see them on a monthly basis, and the church needs to wake up and address it.
Now, I don't want to cover old ground because we've talked about the connection between the UFO phenomenon and Genesis 6 paradigm in other interviews. And I would I'll put a link in the show notes at vftb.net for past interviews if people want to go back and review. I'm assuming that a good percentage of our listeners have heard those and are already on board with that. If you have not dug into the connection between the UFO phenomenon and the Nephilim, we'll refer you back to past interviews. I don't just want to leave that thread hanging there, you know, as though I didn't recognize it, didn't want to address it. We've already covered that, so in the interest of not reviewing material that would be covering old ground for most listeners, we'll move along to the work that you're doing. You talk about photographic evidence and things that you're uncovering today. You've been putting a lot of effort lately into the Watchers DVD series and digging into a couple of different areas of real interest. The trip to Peru was one, which was looking at the anomalous skulls and skeletons in that area. Another, in some of the earlier Watchers DVDs, dealt with physical evidence of the abduction phenomenon. And talk a little bit about that. What sort of physical evidence has been uncovered during the course of your research that would indicate that people are being experimented on by someone or something?
Well, and this is the smoking gun, in my opinion. And, you know, there's a Latin saying, it says res ipsa loquitur. And basically that means the thing speaks for itself. And when we have taken and looked at these implants that have come from people, there's a chain of evidence that would be acceptable in a court of law. We have an X-ray, we have a CAT scan of the object in the person's knee or arm or foot or wherever it is. So we know the person, we've got the X-ray, we've got the CAT scan, now we're in operating theater, and we go in with a C-arm, which allows you to see underneath the skin, and we remove, Dr. Roger Lear removes this implant. And then we take this implant, unbroken chain of evidence, and we cut it in half. The last one had to be taken to a laboratory where it was cut in half with a laser because they couldn't cut it with the with a diamond blade saw. We couldn't even make a dent in it. So they cut it open with a laser, and lo and behold, there are carbon nanotubes, double-walled carbon nanotubes. We were in a laboratory using a scanning electron microscope down very small, like 40,000, 50,000 times. Basically, you're looking at 150 atoms wide. That gives you an idea. 150 atoms wide. That's how deep we're going, and we see that the same coating when you go in to take these implants out, there's this grayish coating which covers the implant, and we believe that this keeps the implant or keeps the body from expunging the implant from the human host. Well, you can't cut that grayish material with a scalpel. Won't cut. What the heck are we looking at? Where's this from? Who's doing this? You know, and these people claim to be abducted by these grays. And what's interesting here, Derek, is there's many similarities between what we read in the Bible and what happens in an abduction phenomena. The phenomena between the jailbreak with Peter and the angel is very similar to what we see in modernity with the alien implant abduction phenomena. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. Let me get back to the lab. So the same gray substance that covers the implant, we now see it at the micro level. That same substance seems to be covering the carbon nanotubes. What are we looking at here? It has a, it's magnetized. We've taken a Gauss meter and gone over the patient. Sure enough, it shows that this implant is magnetized. It also is giving off radio waves between 300 and 350 gigahertz. How can that possibly be? We believe that this is a supercomputer which is changing the host's DNA. Let me tie it all up by saying it this way. If these are the angelic host, the fallen angelic host, under the headship of Lucifer, the fallen cherub, Satan, the dragon, the serpent, whatever name you want to call the guy, the scumbag, then we should see similarities. And sure enough, we do. In Peter's jailbreak, he's held in a jail. He's chained to a wall. There's a jail cell in front of him. He's surrounded by other people who are also chained to walls. There are Roman guards outside in the hallway. And outside, there's a courtyard with a very high wall and very thick, sturdy gates. That's the scene. All of a sudden, an angel appears, like from nowhere, and is in Peter's cell. Peter's not sure. He's awake, asleep, dreaming. He's not sure. The angel tells him to get up. As Peter gets up, his chains fall off of him. The angel hasn't touched him. There's no key. Chains just fall off. The next thing, Peter looks around, and all of his companions are asleep. And he wonders about that. And he gathers up his things. The jail cell opens of its own accord. They go out in the hallway. The Roman soldiers are switched off. They are asleep. And Roman soldiers who fell asleep at their posts immediately were found to do so. Immediately they fall on their swords.
Yeah.
Next, Peter is out in the courtyard. These two huge gates open by themselves. The angel escorts Peter out of the prison. They walk a little further. The angel is gone. Now let's look at an alien abduction phenomena in the 20th century. That was written almost 2,000 years ago. All right? Now we're in modernity, and here's an abduction. A man awakens. There's a being that somehow manifested in his room. Gee, what does that sound like? Mm-hmm. He looks over, tries to move, and he can't. He looks over, and he sees that his wife and his dog are asleep. And he goes, what's going on here? Then he is floated off the bed and floated through the room, through the wall, through the window. What we see is similar. And he's taken to a place, usually a ship, finds himself on a table and probe. There is a lot of similarities between the two. And with the angel, matter and energy is manipulated in ways that we don't understand. Prison doors open by themselves. Guards are switched off. Chains are loosed. How can that possibly be? Gates open by themselves. With the alien abduction phenomena, levitation, people are switched off. Matter and energy is manipulated. They go through walls, windows, all that stuff. There's a similarity because, in my opinion, what we are looking at is the fallen angelic host doing the unthinkable, creating or trying to create some sort of a hybrid being, which goes back to Genesis 6, and it's happening right now.
Just as a word of aside here, folks have been listening for the first 15 minutes of this interview and keep hearing a blunk, blunk noise in the background. I figured out what that was, and you probably have realized that we're using Skype to connect with LA. I have turned off the preference that announces every time one of my contacts logs into Skype. For some reason, I had that preference checked, so we won't hear that little noise. You probably weren't hearing it, LA, but I was hearing it, and I know it's going on the recording. But okay. So anyway, that little distraction has been eliminated for the rest of the program here. Sadly, one of the things that I find distressing is that skeptics looking at this explanation of the jailbreak of Peter and looking at that example and comparing it to modern abduction reports and looking as secular researchers have done, like the late Dr. John Mack of Harvard University, comparing the accounts of victims of satanic ritual abuse with the accounts of abductees and finding over 30 points of correlation, accuse researchers like yourself of applying science fiction to the Bible instead of looking at the accounts that New Agers are looking at and saying, see, our space brothers really do exist, and saying, no, it's not the space brothers. These are not intergalactic travelers. These are interdimensional travelers. And again, even guys like Dr. Mack, Jacques Vallée recognized that it was more likely that we were dealing with entities who've been with us for a very long time. In fact, since the beginning of time, rather than space brothers who've just recently arrived to welcome us into the Galactic Brotherhood or something. So it's not imposing a science fiction gloss on the Bible. It's looking at the science fiction that is trying, the science fiction that New Agers are passing off as a religion to the unchurched and saying, no, no, we've got an explanation here. We as Christians, as believers in the one who created everything, in the omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent God, Lord of all, we have an explanation for this. And we may have to speculate here a little bit, but we can show you from the Bible accounts that mirror in great detail, just as L.A. just explained, things that the New Age crowd, that the ancient astronauts crowd are passing off as their gospel and show them that, no, it's just a cheap copy. I mean, it's what the enemy has been doing all along, what the angelic realm is capable of doing, and we have that here in the Bible. And speaking of evidence, I'll step down off my soapbox now. Let the guest get back to talking. Forgive me. A little cranky. I came down with a little bit of a stomach bug over the weekend. It left me with a little bit of an attitude. So,
Well, that rant was well said. Thank you, Gary.
I just tend to get a little bit irate when I'm accused of leading a heretical cult. So anyway, the evidence that you've been chasing in your book, On the Trail of the Nephilim, and in the Watchers series, and especially on the little field trip you took to Peru with our friendly neighborhood PhD, Dr. Judd Burton.
Yes.
Before we get into that, because that was a really fascinating from Judd's perspective, and I want to hear your take on it again, but I was aware from having done some of my own research into the giants here in North America, and most of us, I guess, when we look at giants in the Bible, if we accept them, you know, consider, okay, that Goliath was real, his brothers were real, Og of Bashan was real, the Nephilim, the Amorites who were described as being as tall as the cedars, you know, they were real. But they were pretty much out of the picture after the time of David and Solomon, for example. There's a lot more evidence for their existence in North America than I realized, and I was aware of some of it. What have you found, and what did you find most surprising when you started digging into the evidence for giants here in North America?
Well, it's not only giants. It's like we realize, and this is all on the trail of a Nephilim, a new book, which has just come out. I believe, and I think Judd will go with me on this, that there are many different Nephilim tribes, and they seem to have different characteristics. One of the most obvious one is one of the tribes is called the Long Necks. Well, there seems to be some sort of genetic manipulation going on in the Levant, or the Promised Land, that's been happening for literally for hundreds of years. And then, of course, a Most High, loving God, gives that mandate to Joshua and Caleb, go in and wipe them all out. Well, the reason why that mandate is there, and unless it's the Nephilim, then we serve a genocidal, homicidal, maniacal God. And which is interesting, you know, the Bible is incredible because it'll prove itself if we dig a little bit. What we see in antiquity is when the Lord raises up a man by the name of Jonah to go and preach to the guys in Nineveh. And Nineveh basically invented the word barbarian. These guys were unbelievable. And I have it. I have a whole chapter about that in the book On the Trail of the Nephilim, because when you got to Nineveh, that you didn't want to go there, but if you found yourself in Nineveh, the first thing you would see is a row of stakes around the entire city. And on the top of those stakes were the severed head of Nineveh's enemies staring at you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, welcome to Nineveh, your head could be here, you know, that type of thing.
They would speed laws strictly enforced.
Exactly. They would flay their enemies alive and then tack the skin on the walls. Yet, what we see with these bloodthirsty Ninevites is grace and mercy is extended to them. God raises up Jonah and sends Jonah there. We don't see it at all with the conquest of Canaan. It's not there. What we see is a very specific mandate to go in and wipe them out, men, women, and children. So now we're like, whoa. And unless a Christian understands what that means, then we're serving a genocidal, maniacal, homicidal, crazed God who favors one group over another group. But the moment we plug in the Nephilim, oh, I see. It's the same thing he's been doing ever since the garden. He's trying to contaminate the messianic line. He's trying to raise up an army. Oh, gee, look, he did it in Sodom and Gomorrah. Oh, what happened there? Wiped them all out. Oh, the same mandate applies here. Noah is pure in all his generations way back in the flood. And there's a vetting process here, Derek, in my opinion. Mm. The Most High God says, Noah, you, your wife, your sons, and your sons' wives. That's a vetting process, in my opinion. And for him to call it out with that kind of specificity, if there's a Nephilim on board with one of the wives, why does he miss it? Then he's not all-knowing. He's going to destroy everybody else and allow one to get on the ship? I don't believe it, not for a second. So there's a vetting process in Scripture. Just like Jesus says to his disciples, you are my disciples. I've handpicked you. Ha-ha. But one, and he knows who it is, he calls them out. One of you is Satan's son, basically. That's what he's saying. Mm-hmm. Well, the Most High God, Jehovah, would have known that. He would have said, well, Ham, your wife can't go on. Or, you know, she's Nephilim, but I'm letting her run anyway. There's not that. It's a vetting process. You, your wife, Noah, you, your wife, your sons and their wife. All I'm trying to get to is here, that what we see, anytime a Nephilim are present, we see zero grace, zero mercy. We see wipe them all out. We see total destruction. That's what we see. And that same thing is happening in the conquest of the Levant. Here's the rub. And Jed Burton will back me up on this, and he's written about it in his book. There was a dispersion. Some of these Nephilim tribes saw what was happening, and they fled. They fled for their lives. Some of them went northward. Some of them and into Europe, and eventually over to the Americas, where they settled in around the Great Lakes. Others got on ships and fled across the Atlantic and settled in South America, worked their way up into Peru. I believe that the Paracas culture, which we spent so much time with, and other areas in around South America, there's a direct correlation, in my opinion, to fallen angelic architecture, what we would call Nephilim architecture, and there's a genetic program which is being once again manipulated, or the fallen ones are manipulating the human genome, trying to create a hybrid. And I believe we found evidence of that.
Well, again, the evidence, and we'll talk about the Paracas culture and your trip down to Peru here again a little bit more detail in just a moment. But in North America, we find from the 19th century, as white settlers moved westward through across the Appalachians, through down the Ohio River Valley into the southern states, report after report that show up in local papers about skeletons of unusual size. How many areas were those skeletons found in? How common are those accounts? And what conclusions do you draw from them?
Well, they're basically everywhere, and part of being on the trail in Volume 2, which is coming up, we've got a lot of newspaper clippings, which we use. We got about 500 of them. Out of the 500, we pared it down to 50. Out of that, we published about 20 of them in the book. They're just so numerous, it's absurd. Obviously, there was a race that predated Native Americans. They were everywhere, even outside here in Catalina Island, which is right outside where I live in the Santa Monica Mountains off the coast, the west coast of California. There's tales of giants between 8 and 10 feet being unearthed. And in Volume 2, I will address that. I went out and I looked at these very old records, very old photographs from the 20s. And what I found there was startling. And all that will be in Volume 2. I'm also headed up to Wisconsin in the not too distant future, and also North Carolina. There are reports, oral reports from not only the Native Americans, but then the settlers who come in and begin to discover 9, 10, 11 footers. The modern day archaeologist tells us, oh, this is just all exaggeration. The Native Americans, let's say in California, were about 5'3" tall. I've got proof, and I can't talk about it now, but I will talk about it at a future date, that giants existed on Catalina Island. And I will show that in Volume 2 of On the Trail of the Nephilim. And that's all I'll say about that. But let's move over to, let's say, Ohio. We get reports of 9, 10, 11 footers. Well, we have newspaper reports where doctors are examining the skeletons and saying the thing had to have been at least 10 feet. And yet the archaeologists will try to tell us that a man of letters, an MD, over 100 years ago, let's say, didn't know how to use a tape measure, which is insulting. It's a straw man argument. I mean, it's absolutely an absurd position to take, and yet they take this, and they insist that these men of letters did not know how to measure, or that a doctor would not know how to measure a disarticulated skeleton. Well, wait a minute. A doctor can take a femur bone, and just from the femur, he can extrapolate or at least estimate the size of that particular skeleton, or that man or woman was in real life. He can do that. He's trained to do that. He's not a forensic anthropologist. I get that. But as an MD, he can make a very good educated guess as to what he's looking at. And I find that those who poo-poo this and tell us that it didn't happen are hiding something. What they're hiding is that there was a race that was in this country about 3,500 years ago, which corresponds, by the way, with the conquest of Canaan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. And this is what's going on. These beings fled and came over here and basically set up shop. And one of the more prolific places is actually in the Ohio Valley. When you go to the Great Circle Mound or the Great Serpent Mound in Chillicothe, when we see the Octagon Mound in Newark, Ohio, and we realize that whoever this culture was, they were creating very large edifices which could only be seen from the air. When you're in this Great Circle Mound, you can see that it's a mound, it's a circle, but we can't appreciate the complexity and how it originally tied in with the Octagon Mound just a short distance away. All this, of course, can be seen from the air. But it gets better than this, Derek, and I illustrated this in On the Trail of the Nephilim. And in my opinion, it's yet another smoking gun which ties back to the Nephilim and actually to Mount Hermon. And I'm at liberty to talk about this. It's in On the Trail, Volume 1, but we actually expounded on this. It'll be another graph, and another picture will be in On the Trail Volume 2, because we didn't have this information when we went to press, but we have it now. Basically, I saw this clip of this guy by the name of Kelsey Stone, whose parents and grandparents actually bought a piece of land which they called America's Stonehenge. It's been carbon dated to be about 4,000 years old. A henge is a circle. And on the outside of the circle of the hedge are standing stones. And these standing stones relate the summer and winter solstices and the equinoxes and also the lunar rise and all this. And so Kelsey Stone was doing some work on Google Earth and decided to draw a line from the center of the hedge in New Hampshire, called America's Stonehenge, out to the summer solstice standing stone. And he continued that line. And all of this is in the book. Kelsey was kind enough to let me reprint this. And it's all in the book. And we've got links to his site. Anyway, he extended it and extended it and extended it a little further. And sure enough, to his absolute utter amazement, it intersected the center trilithon in Stonehenge, England, thousands of miles away.
Hmm.
I showed this to a surveyor out here in California, who looked at it, was absolutely astounded by it. And they said, is there any way to do this in antiquity? And he said, no, there is no way. You've got to have satellites. You've got to have triangulation. There's no way to do it. I said, except from the air, right? And he says, yeah. Well, guess what? Who's the prince of the power of the air?
Uh-huh.
But Derek, it gets better. When Kelsey extended the line further, he wound up in Beirut, Lebanon. Beirut, Lebanon is the home of the Phoenicians. But the Phoenicians are the descendants of the Canaanites, and the Canaanites were a Nephilim tribe. So he stopped there because he didn't understand the biblical, the profound biblical implications of what he was uncovering. He didn't know about Mount Hermon. We extended the line, and the line falls at the base of Mount Hermon.
Sure.
Which is absolutely unbelievable, because that's where the 200 watcher angels descended in the days of Jared. We have a link between what happened at Noah's flood to the Canaanites, the Nephilim tribes, the Phoenicians, Stonehenge, England, and then Stonehenge in the Americas, specifically in New Hampshire. That is absolutely one of the most profound smoking guns we have ever uncovered.
If you extend that line any further, and I'm just curious because I live not very far from this area and have lived close to it for the better part of the last 20 years or so. If you extend that further, where does that fall in relation to Cahokia in Illinois, near St. Louis?
I have not done that, and okay. that's one of the things that we need to do.
Just curious because I know at one of the sites at Cahokia, the mounds there, which is actually closer to Collinsville, Illinois, is a site called Woodhenge, which is a series of
yes.
right wooden posts that were. I took a picture. My daughter was about 8 years old at the time, standing at Woodhenge, I understand that. Some friends of ours are going to be going there relatively soon to take a look at the site. Doug Krieger and Dean McGriff indicated at Pikes Peak that that's something they were going to take a look at, but I digress. One more quick digression, just because it happens to fall in a little bit of history that I find interesting. One of the areas that was not really settled by any of the Native American tribes at the time of the arrival of white settlers from Europe was Kentucky. It was considered open hunting ground for all of the tribes in the area, the Wyandotte, the Seneca, the Cherokee, the Iroquois who came down from further north, the Miami, the Shawnee, but none of them settled there. And while it's not certain, one of the possible etymological origins of the name Kentucky is an Indian word meaning that dark and bloody ground. So, not certain. There's some dispute about that, but that is a possibility. So,
well, I mean, let me add to that. I was just in Nevada, and I was there with Joe Taylor, the Mount Blanco Museum, and also Ron Moorhead. Both men accompanied were part of our team when we went down to Peru. And the reason why we were there was we were examining the legend of the Paiutes and the red-haired giants. And we also went to the Lovelock Museum and got to talk to the curator, and she's a very wonderful woman and allowed us access. We couldn't see the skulls that were there, but we could see pictures of them. So I have photographs of photographs. And these are very large skulls, which do very, very robust mandible or lower jaw. They certainly seem to be something more than what we see the typical Native American. We also spoke to Paiute elders that were there. And I asked him point blank, I said, you know, the white man doesn't believe your oral tradition. I happen to believe in your oral tradition that there was a race of red-haired giants out of a Lovelock cave. And this woman told me without any equivocation on her part that, yes, that's what was there. And our people killed them. And she just tells the story of that Sarah Winnemucca's book. And I said, well, would you ever go to the cave? And she said, no, we look at that cave as like a bad place, a taboo place. We would never go there after we killed the giants. And so we hear this red hair giant story being told over and over and over again. And what's interesting is when we get to Peru, not to switch here, but I will, we get red-haired skulls down there. And this should not be at all. According to the Darwinian paradigm, according to the Beringian theory that during the last ice age and the melting of the ice, the Bering Strait was open and all these people came over to this country hunting megafauna, woolly mammoths and that sort of thing, which is just insane. I mean, it's just crazy. And even now, there are some archaeologists who are beginning to break away from the whole Bering Strait theory or the whole Beringian theory that has held everyone sort of enslaved intellectually for, you know, decades now and continues to do so. That's what's taught. And the moment we step outside that, we see, wait a minute, here's a race in Paracas, Peru with red hair and their elongated skulls. Where do they just come from? And they show up about 3,500 years ago, which again fits the timeline of the conquest of Canaan.
Hmm.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Your trip to Peru, and I talked to Jed Burton about it, and he was... You know, in typical Judd Burton style, you know, he's pretty low key in his description, but it's some fascinating stuff. Even you know, with his delivery, and I love him and really appreciate his scholarly approach to a topic that can really be sensationalized. And some people may dismiss it because of the sensational aspects of it, but he says flat out that some of the skulls that you guys looked at. He, as an anthropologist, as an archaeologist, could not come up with a known explanation that some of the anomalies on these skulls were just beyond his capability to explain. What did you guys find there? Who did you bring along to look at these things to give you an educated look at, or analysis of what you were looking at, and what conclusions did you draw from your trip to Peru?
Well, I was going to get funny and imitate Judd, but I won't because I know we're pressed for time here. But, we brought Ron Moorhead, who is a Bigfoot researcher, who was very interested because of the sagittal crest that people see in these Bigfoot sightings. I like Ron, and I agree that what these Bigfoot creatures may be is some sort of modern-day Nephilim, which are, by the way, interdimensional and can pop in and out. That's a different subject. But we bought Judd and who's obviously an archaeologist, anthropologist, as you mentioned, also Joe Teller, to cast a skull. I have shown Joe's cast, which, by the way, is just amazing, to medical doctors who have weighed in, along with a forensic anthropologist who have just been startled by what they see. And we've also had Dennis look at the dentation of the skull, and we've now placed the age. We placed it as a female between 18 and 25 years old, and therefore the fact that the parietal suture is not visible at all makes no sense. In other words, and let me back up here because I'm, talking and because I've been doing this for since February, and I know the terms, but there's a lot of people out there who have no idea what I'm talking about. The human skull is comprised of four plates: a frontal plate, two parietal, which are on top, and then the occipital plate, which is the rear plate. They are held together with look like sutures. And when a child is born on the frontal plate, there's a place called the fontanelle, that soft spot. When a child is about 2 to 3 years old, that fontanelle grows together. The sutures come together, and there's no longer that soft spot in the baby's skull. A normal human skull should have two parietal plates. The skulls that we saw over and over and over again in Peru had only one parietal plate. And as a judge will ascertain, or a judge will back me up on this rather, that there's not even a hint of a parietal suture, which should go from the top of the frontal plate back to the occipital plate, thus dividing the two parietals into a right and a left parietal plate. It's not there. Not even a hint of a suture. And look, we saw cradle headboarding down there, and these had two parietal plates. The ones that showed no indication of cradle headboarding had one parietal plate, and that certainly is bizarre. And what the theory, and again, it's a theory, what we're saying is this is a Nephilim tribe, angelic host, fallen angelic host, set up shop in this area, and genetic manipulation was going on. That's the theory. And what we've got is we've got a smoking gun, because we took the red hair from one of these mummies, and that skull was at least 2,000 years old, at least 2,000 years old, might have been older, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We took some of the red hair back, and the reason why we did that, we wanted to see, is it dyed or not? If it's not dyed, now we've got a real problem, because red-haired people shouldn't be there, according to the archaeologists and the anthropologists.
Right.
Shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So we took the red hair back from Paracas. We went into a lab, and we put it under a machine by the name of, it's called Raman spectroscopy. And we took a human hair, we took a dyed human hair, the red hair from Paracas, and the fourth hair was the wild card. And we had access to a hair which had been, and this is where, I better sit down for this one, folks. We had access to a man who claimed to have been abducted and forced to have sex with a female hybrid alien, okay? Mm. And this female hybrid had long, whitish hair. When the man awakened from his abduction, he found himself back in the bedroom the next morning. All the different side effects and all the stuff he's trying to sort out what's really going on. He found on his body several of these long, white hairs. He had the presence of mind to put them in a plastic bag and send them to one of the researchers, and that researcher was with us in the lab while we were doing the Raman spectroscopy. That is the fourth hair. The human hair is number one. Two is the dyed human hair. Three is the red hair from Paracas. Four is the white hair from the abduction, from the so-called female hybrid alien. Physical evidence, Derek, mm-hmm. Physical evidence. hardcore science. Now we're looking at it under Raman spectroscopy, which measures the molecular structure of whatever it is you're putting to be examined. The human hair, and it plots it on a graph so you can see it. The human hair comes in on the left side of the graph about halfway up, and it just kind of makes a gentle arc and then goes down. The dyed human hair comes into the graph, plotted on the graph. The slope begins on the left-hand side of the graph, but then abruptly curves straight up and out the top of the graph and is gone. So the dyed human hair bears no resemblance at all to a normal human hair. It's been chemically altered.
Right.
You can see that. And the Raman spectroscopy shows that. This is where it gets interesting, and all of us fell out of our chairs. The red Paracas hair and the white hybrid hair come in at pretty much at the same place towards the bottom of the graph. And their slopes are almost identical the whole way. Every little zig and zag that's plotted on the graph, these two hairs, they match. And that shouldn't be. One is 2,000 years old. One is less than 10 years old. And what it does, Derek, in my opinion, you know, it's not conclusive, but what it does is it bolsters our theory that these same fallen angelic hosts were genetically manipulating, playing with the genome in antiquity, and are once again doing it in modernity. And this creates a link. And Jesus' words in particular should be just like a flare going off in our brains. Like the days of Noah, so it will be when I return. This is hardcore physical scientific evidence, which you just can't dispute. I mean, I've had people look at this. We're having a technician and the scientist who conducted the test. He's writing a full report, which will be enclosed in On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 2. We also are taking the white hybrid hair and attempting to get DNA results on it.
We look forward to seeing those results. And just to be clear, as to the direction that you're approaching this, you're looking at this and saying, you know, these pieces of evidence support the theory that what we are looking at now with the modern UFO phenomenon is not aliens who are intruding on our, you know, into the lives of abductees and messing with them. What we are not saying is that there were ancient aliens who were abducting people or creating these DNA programs back in the days of Noah and in the days of Lot. It's the exact opposite of that. What we're seeing is an angelic program of DNA manipulation.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, because again, there are skeptics who are taking this and twisting it around and attacking a straw man, which is that we're somehow looking at this and saying there were UFOs and space aliens who are messing with us back in biblical times, and that's exactly the opposite of what's being said here.
Yeah, I can't make it any clearer than this. What we're looking at is the evil machinations of the fallen angelic hosts, the evil machinations of the fallen angelic hosts, which are trying to manipulate the human genome. That's what we're looking at.
Okay. Now, we can see that in biblical times, the possible goal of corrupting the bloodline, especially before the blood of Jesus, or before the time of Jesus, was to prevent the birth of a Messiah, who was fully human and fully God. What would be the purpose, if you had to speculate, and this is necessarily speculation because we just absolutely don't know for sure, but what purpose would a DNA manipulation program have today?
Chuck Messer actually addresses this. Satan is outnumbered 2-1, according to the biblical text. He's trying to create an army, and nothing would surprise me at all. The hybrids are the best kept secret in the known and unknown universe. He's been at this and doing it very vigorously, literally for decades. He's also perfecting this chip, which I believe will be then become the mark of the beast. I believe it is the prototype to what we know as the mark of the beast. And when they show up, they'll claim to be from Reticuli or the Pleiades or wherever. And because of a Darwinian paradigm, which most people hold, that even the elect would be deceived if that were possible. Unless the person knows who he's looking at ahead of time, a priori, when this stuff begins to manifest, people will believe a lie. They'll believe the strong delusion, as Jim Cunningham likes to call it, from 2 Thessalonians again. when this thing shows up, unless you unless we understand what we're looking at, we will be deceived. It's so easy to be deceived because these ships will be absolutely overwhelming to look at. They'll have what they will call a DNA upgrade, and a line for that will go around the block. And how do I know? Because the Bible tells me in the book of Revelation that you won't be able to buy, sell, or trade without it. That's criteria one. Two, anyone who takes the mark is short of a lake of fire. Three, you take the mark, grievous sores appear in your body. Whoa, what the heck is that about? And the fourth one, which is really overlooked, in those days, what days? The days of the mark, men and women will seek death and not find it. And this DNA enhancer, this little microchip, which I've held in my hand, I've looked at it under a scanning electron microscope. They are supercomputers, and I believe they are manipulating the DNA. Why? Because the fallen one hates us and wants as many of us to turn and not wind up with a loving God of the universe and be with him. And so he's trying to create man in his own image, Derek. That's what he's trying to do.
Now, this leads to a question that was raised at the PID Radio Cafe over the weekend. And I answered, and I think it was maybe a little more blunt than I needed to be, because it was a disturbing question to me. Because it hit a little close to home based on an experience I had when I was in radio news and had to report on a story of a woman who believed she was listening to voices telling her to save her children from damnation by taking a 5-inch steak knife to them while they were strapped into their car seats in the back seat of her car. If this is a mark that would change DNA, a genetic marker, there is some concern by listeners, and I know because it was raised in the in our little online forum there, that this could be implanted in someone against their will or without their knowledge, like perhaps unconscious, recovering from an accident or in a coma of some sort, and then be condemned to what Revelation 14 says is a never-ending torment, or the smoke of their torment will go up forever and ever for something that they didn't ask for, didn't want, and was imposed on them against their will. Do you see that? How do you view that in the context of the gospel as a whole?
Well, I'll tell you. I have two cases. A man and a woman, both abductees, no collusion. They do not know each other. And both of them told me exactly the same story. They were abducted, and they felt like something was put into them. And then they realized that it was in their forehead. Isn't that interesting? Mm. Right above the eyebrow. That's the forehead. And they lived with this thing for a while. And both of them did the same thing, which is just bizarre. One day they got up, and they said, enough. And they went in. And one was a woman. And they took a razor blade and cut the thing out themselves.
Wow. Ouch.
And, yeah, well, but that's what they did. And in both cases, the thing popped out and fell into the sink.
Hmm.
Unbelievable. Look, let's walk through this. If and that's the scenario. Let's say I awaken in a hospital and, someone, I see this mark. And I ask, well, what's happened here? You guys put something in me. I would do the same thing, knowing what I know. Are you kidding me? You're not putting anything in my body. And look, when these things begin to happen, if the church is still here, and let's hope we're not, it'll be very interesting to see how people deal with this. If it's put into somebody, they can take it out again, even if it's against their will. Remember, you can't. There seems to be in the text, you won't be able to buy, sell, or trade without it. Well, what about people who won't take the mark, who willingly refuse to take the mark?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think there's going to be people like that. So,
sure.
Look, I don't have all the answers here, Derek, but I truly believe that if you don't want it, you won't have to take it, and that may have dire consequences. Maybe that's when you get beheaded. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how this stuff's going to play out. I don't have all the answers. Nobody does. That's why some of it is speculation.
No, I agree. And sorry to interrupt, but the reason I was disturbed by this, because I think that, and I think Revelation 14, 9 and 10, Revelation 14, 9 gives us the clue here. If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand. If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark, if you don't worship the beast and its image, I think you're okay. At least I pray that's the case, because I see that, if for example, somebody is unconscious and is forced to take a mark that he doesn't want or doesn't even know that he's getting, I don't see a loving ultimately just God condemning one to the eternal torment, if one, in fact, is a believer at the time he slips into a coma. I mean, we're getting into some really, really hypothetical stuff, but the reason this question bothered me was that there are people out there who will take this question and say, gosh, if I can be given this mark without my knowledge, and my children can be condemned to eternal torment without their knowledge, you know, what if this genetic mark isn't a chip that goes in my hand? What if it's some chemical that's put into our water or our food? What about the store-bought food? We don't know really what's in there. And we see, sadly, tragically, we see stories like this popping up in the news every now and again. Often, I would suggest, with people who are listening to the enemy, but women in particular seem subject to this. There was a case just last year, 2012, in the St. Louis area, of a woman who killed her children believing that she was saving them from damnation. And this is not a unique case. I think, sadly, this is the tragic end of this type of thing. If people believe they can be given the mark against their knowledge or against their will and condemned to eternal torment, well, we better try to save ourselves while there's still time. And I think that's a dangerous, dangerous teaching.
And I agree. And I'm not you know, down with that on any level. It's the same thing when I get from people who write me, "Dear LA, I think I'm a Nephilim," and I write them back and go, "Excuse me, trust me, you're not."
Yeah, if you can ask the question and ask, "Can I be saved?" and are concerned about it, then you're not.
Exactly, and that's. I mean, this is like
right.
This whole thing, it's just crazy paranoia. And look, I don't believe that that's what's going to happen for a minute. Not for a minute do I believe that. It'll be a conscious choice where people will deliberately fall after and believe the lie. That's what we're looking at. You got to take all the scripture here. And they're going to look at this thing. God sends them strong delusion because they do not believe the truth. But I truly believe that many of the believers, if not all of us, might be out of here. So we might not have to deal with this stuff at all. We don't know.
Amen. Yeah.
You know, lots of different positions there, but that's my hope.
Well, education is the answer. As the prophet Hosea said, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Or actually, God said to the prophet Hosea, you know, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And that's the reason we look at these topics that some wish we would just leave alone. It is a disturbing topic. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail the topic, but that was something that just was really weighing on me. And I read that question because, again, I was, you know, for whatever it was worth, I broke that story in the Chicago area back in, and I forget the year now, about 1981 or 82. But it's not a unique story. It's something that pops up every now and again, and it's a lie from the pit of hell. You need to save your children by killing them. You need to save yourself by killing yourself. No, that's not the way it's going to go down. If you worship the beast and its image and take the mark, if you worship the beast and its image, and as L.A. said, and if you're capable of asking the question, I think I might be irredeemable. If you can even ask the question, you're not irredeemable.
Yeah,
God
absolutely
loves you and wants you to accept Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior so that you don't have to suffer the punishment for all eternity.
All day long.
Ultimately, you know, because these are dark topics and we look at the power of the enemy and the things that were done to those who tried to defy the enemy without the power of Jesus Christ. In fact, even those who do suffer physically, because we know that many of the saints will be beheaded between now and when God calls time up, says time's up. It's not going to be an easy path to set. What's the good news out of all of this? Let's leave this on an up note if we can.
Absolutely. Look, all this is headed towards one event. There's been an event that preceded this, the greatest event in all of history, in my opinion. And that is when Jesus took back the title of the earth by his blood on Calvary, his willing sacrifice for the entire human race, for all people everywhere. Jews, Muslims, Hindus, people that can hear this. That's the good news. By believing on him who was sent, Yeshua, Jesus, and by believing that by his blood sacrifice, we are cleansed from all our little nasty stuff that we do, and we all do it, we have eternal life. You can't add anything to it. You can't take anything away. We have eternal life. That's the deal. All this leads to, we are in a cosmic chess match, title of one of my books, and we see this, the fallen one, Satan, the dragon, still continues to try to fight and mess things up. We look at the evil in the world. Derek, you just talked about a woman, you know, killing her children to save them. That's the face of evil. It is. It's what it is.
Right.
We see the stuff happening in Nairobi last week. That's the face of evil. Evil has a face. That's what it is. The school children who were killed because they were in a Christian school, you know, stabbing their beds. That's the face of evil. That's what it is. And it's fueled by the dark side. It's fueled by the fallen one. At some point, and I believe it's soon, in the near future, he is going to come back. Yeshua, Jesus, will come back with the host of heaven. And he rides in to that area, and his feet touch the Mount of Olives, and that baby splits in two. And by the breath of his coming, he destroys the fallen one and the Antichrist and the beast, and they're cast in the lake of fire. It's game over, literally, for 1,000 years at that point. It is game over. And he heals the nations. There's a clip that I show at the end of my Holocaust presentation, and this is the up note. And it's a harbinger, a precursor of what is to come. There's a Jewish rabbi who is speaking at a conference, and this man comes in on the side, and people know who he is, and he's given a microphone. He was speaking earlier, and he says, "I was an Islamic terrorist. I was a Palestinian terrorist sent here into this country to kill people, to kill Jews, to kill Americans. And Jesus came," and you know what he says, Derek? He says, "Jesus came to me, and he healed my mind." And then he kneels before the Jew and says, the rabbi, and says, "Forgive us, O Israel. Forgive us, O Israel." And the whole place goes bonkers. Everyone's crying. The rabbi goes down on his knees. They embrace. The whole place just goes crazy, completely crazy. Then the Palestinian, former Palestinian terrorist, goes, "Arise, O Israel. Arise, O Israel." And the rabbi stands up. The whole place is absolutely bonkers. I mean, if you go to the video and see it, it's Jason Sobel. It'll blow your mind. That is a harbinger of what is going to happen on this planet when he comes back. Because every eye will see him, and every eye will go, "Oh my gosh, it's true." And those of us will be with him when he comes back on that. We'll ride with him into that battle, and we're going to kick some demonic butt. And we take back the planet. And that's the hope. That's where all it's going. In the meantime, we're on this side of it. And what I do, what I try to do, is warn the church and warn people of the deception which is coming. And that's what the books and the DVDs and everything I do here, we do, my partner Richard and I, is really about.
L.A. Marzulli is the host of Acceleration Radio, Thursday evenings, 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Central Time. Put a link in the show notes, vftb.net. You'll find everything there at lamarzulli.net, lamarzulli.wordpress.com. Also, links to his books and the DVD set. When is Watchers 7 on the way?
Well, Watchers 7 is on the way probably about a week or two before Thanksgiving. We are really excited about it because this one is on UFOs, and it's called Physical Evidence. We're also working on another book, which is called Alien Interviews Volume 2, and we're taking Alien Interviews 1 and taking editing a lot out, bringing in all sorts of new material, plus four-color photos. So both of those will be released at the same time. We are excited about it because it's physical evidence, folks. Here it is.
All right. L.A., a pleasure and an education as always. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Hey, Derek, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Now, I promise you I didn't want the interview to focus on skeptics and critics of the work of L.A. Marzulli and others in this sort of alt-Christian milieu, folks like Doug Hamp, Russ Dizdar, Chuck Missler, Tom Horn, Rob Skiba, and others. But I think it's important to talk about why we do what we do so that it's not misunderstood. If you want to be critical, that's fine. We're not all going to agree, and I understand that when it comes to the issue of sin and salvation, the Nephilim and the UFO phenomenon are kind of ancillary, but rather important to understanding the Old Testament message. And the Old Testament does include a lot of killing, and a lot of killing ordered by God. And that killing doesn't make any sense unless you understand it as a program to eliminate the hybrid offspring of angels and human women who were bent on the destruction of the Hebrews and the Israelites, the bloodline from which the Messiah would come. The Old Testament makes a lot more sense when you understand it as a war between the rest of the world, which is under the control of the fallen watchers, and God's chosen people who were His and His alone. That war between a supernatural enemy, when we look at the modern UFO phenomenon, which I think we can all agree is real, not that UFOs are real, that's not what we're saying, but that the UFO phenomenon is real. There are some striking parallels and explanations that can be drawn from Scripture. Now, necessarily, this involves some speculation, but better to speculate along biblical lines than to impose a scientistic or New Age interpretation onto the Bible, which is what the ancient alien prophets like Giorgio Tsokalos and Eric Von Daniken are doing. Because while people look at the Bible, and I've talked about this before, the research done by the Barna Group, many who call themselves Christians don't really believe what the Bible says. The percentage of people who call themselves Christians who actually have a biblical worldview, which Barna defined as believing in certain core tenets of the faith, the virgin birth, the sinless life of Jesus, the literal existence of Satan, things like that, is a fraction, a small fraction of the people who are sitting in the pews on Sunday morning. So when, say, as in the Stephenville, Texas flap, or with the Phoenix Lights, which have been debunked by Chris White, but still, many people who saw those events or read about them later on the internet and are reading about these events from the perspective of a secular ufologist, they're not going to get a scriptural explanation, a biblical explanation. We may be able to debunk some of these events, for example, the Phoenix Lights. Again, Chris White did so. And it's possible that the Stephenville flap was a secret military craft. There was a very famous flap over southern Illinois on my birthday in 2000, which was witnessed by trained spotters, police. And it was another flying triangle, which is a common type of craft cited in UFO reports. But not all of them are so easily explained. And again, when we look at this from a biblical perspective, we're not claiming that fallen angels are flying around in physical aircraft. It is that they are trying to manifest a lie that we, with our Western scientistic minds, will accept. And certainly since 1947 and the Roswell incident and the flood of science fiction movies that have followed in those years, we are certainly programmed through our pop culture and entertainment to accept the concept of ET. In fact, if research is to be believed, as I mentioned a few weeks back, more Americans believe that the Earth has been visited by aliens than have a biblical worldview. More Americans believe in ET, as he's defined by movies and television programs, than God, as he is defined in the Bible. And as a Christian, that should disturb you, and that's why we do what we do. Until next time, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.